Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show about books and writing with a local slant. Featured guest on today's show is Jan Casey, here to talk about her debut novel, The Women of Waterloo Bridge. We'll also hear from Janet Todd on her novel, Don't You Know There's a War On? And Imogen Alexander from the art gallery Kettle's Yard talks about a new book they've produced aimed at children on the work of the artist Alfred Wallace. So we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Jan. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you for asking me.
Lovely to speak to you. And I say, writing with a local slant, you're based in Norwich now, but you used to live and work in Cambridge, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I lived in Cambridge for many years, worked in Cambridge in education. And I'd wanted to be a writer since I was a child and did my MA at Anglia Ruskin.
And that MA in creative writing that you did at Anglia Ruskin University, how important was that to you?
It was very important to me. It came at a time I found myself with a void in my life, and I saw an advert for the first MA in creative writing at Anglia Ruskin, and I'd always wanted to write, so it just came at the perfect time.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, as I say, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now. Is music important to you, Jan?
Yes, it is very important to me. Lyrics in particular, I think, are very important to me. They signify certain times in my life when I've been happy or I've been particularly sad. And the first piece of music,
it's Louis Armstrong, It's a Wonderful World. Why this one?
That was both of my parents' favourite song. And so it reminds me of them. And the lyrics are just so simple, but just so heartrending. I often think that if people could just live by those lyrics, we would live such happy, happy lives.
As It's a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong, the first choice of music from our featured guest on Bookmark today, Jan Casey. Jan has twice been highly commended in the National Centre for Writing's Escalator Awards. She's had work published in Prima and as part of the Norwich City of Stories campaign. The Women of Waterloo Bridge is her first novel, a novel I really very much enjoyed. So, Jan, for the people who haven't read the novel, because it is only just out, what's it about?
As the title says, it's about the women who worked on Waterloo Bridge during the Second World War. The bridge was faulty in between the wars. The structure of it became faulty. It needed to be raised to the ground and rebuilt. And that was started before the Second World War. But when the men went away to fight, the women had to be called in to bridge that gap, if you like, in employment on the bridge. There were 500 men working on the bridge before Second World War was declared. During the first year of the war, there were only 50 men left, most of those in higher positions. So women had to come in and create the labour, really, or provide the labour. I was fascinated when I first heard that story, absolutely fascinated that I didn't know more about it. These women who one minute were working in jobs like teaching or were housewives, and who then were suddenly on a huge construction site, something that they never ever thought they would be a part of. I thought it would be best if I concentrated on three women from different backgrounds in London and tried to write about the experience from their three points of view.
And when did you find out about this story? When did you first hear about this story? Because it's not very well known, is it? I mean, I didn't know this story. I didn't know women were involved in the building of this bridge.
No, I had no idea. Despite having a mother who lived in London during the Second World War, I had never heard this story until about 10 or 12 years ago when I was on a Thames riverboat cruise. The pilot was pointing out all of the sights along the way, and he said, "Oh, we're coming up now to the Waterloo Bridge. also known as the Ladies' Bridge, because it was rebuilt by women during the Second World War. And then as we went under it, he said, oh, careful now, it doesn't fall on you, you know.
Yeah, hilarious, yeah.
I just had no idea. It was a story that I couldn't leave alone and that just wouldn't leave me alone either.
And I'm guessing for something like this, the amount of research you had to do is quite substantial, because you had to research about bridge building as well as what it was like to live during that time. There's a very strong sense of time in it. Where did you start on bridge building? I mean, did you know much about engineering to begin with?
I have no idea about engineering, but I was in touch with someone from the Institute of Civil Engineers, their historical society, and he helped me to check through all of my references to bridge building at that time. Women's Engineering Society, they were very helpful. And I paid a couple of visits to the Metropolitan Archives in London, as well as the Imperial War Museum. But as I went along writing the novel, I did have to research the terms that were used, terms like on the tools, on the flame, terms that were bandied about on a construction site. And then the research for the actual time, I did that really as I went along. So if I needed to refer to clothes rationing, for instance, then I researched that and wrote what I needed into the novel at that point. So I didn't sit down and do masses of research and then refer back to it. I tried to do it as I went along.
Because it permeates everything, doesn't it, that time? It permeates the language, what they wore, what they ate, where they were able to go. It's a different world almost.
Completely different world from the world that we know now. I do remember some anecdotes about the war from my parents, who talked a lot about it. So I do remember some of their turns of phrase, their references to letter writing instead of using the telephone or text that we do now. All of those sorts of little things, a lot of them I got from my parents and my aunts and uncles, and then just doing research.
You tell the story from three women's points of view. Why did you choose these particular women? They're very different. They're from very different classes. I guess you're wanting all of that. But where did you start in terms of putting them together?
I wanted to show that women working on the bridge could have been any woman or every woman, if that makes sense. So I wanted them to be different ages and have different prior experiences. But I wanted them all to have experienced something quite deeply traumatic on one of the worst nights of the Blitz that then eventually led them to work on the bridge.
Yeah, the precariousness of life comes through really strongly in the novel.
Yes, and at that particular period of time, when there was such a class divide, I wanted to show that the war was in some way breaking that down.
There's still the enjoyment in life, though. You still get that, and they still go out. They smoke. Oh, chimneys, all of them, and they're always out dancing.
Oh, yes, they had so much fun. And I think that was something that was a wonderful thing for women at that time. Although it was a very difficult life for them, they pursued fun, whether it was because they thought they might never have fun again, or just because they needed a release from the terrible situation going on around them. But yeah, they were very fun-loving.
And they worked alongside men on the bridge, didn't they? So it wasn't just women, it was women and men. They were known as green labour, is that right?
Yes, they were, because they had never done anything like that before. So it was all new.
And what was the proportion of men to women working on the bridge?
Well, there would have been hundreds of women working on the bridge and only perhaps about 50 men. And as I tried to point out in the novel, those men had the really good positions. The women were just labour until a few years in, when some of them were promoted Even the women working on the flames with the welding irons, they would not have been paid the same amount that men had been paid doing that job before they left for the war.
And it was quite dangerous work, wasn't it? I mean, they were very high up. They didn't have the health and safety we have now, less scaffolding, that kind of thing. And as you said, close to flames, dealing with heavy girders, things like that.
Yes, there were a lot of casualties.
And needless to say, they weren't paid the same.
And they probably, I dare say, wouldn't have been compensated either.
Some did go on, I mean, certainly in your novel, is this true? Some went on to be foremen, as it were, leading teams and operating cranes as well.
That's right, yes. As the time went on and more men left those positions, then the powers or the authorities, the managers, didn't have any other choice but to promote women, train them into those positions, yes. But I think that they were very few.
And what was the attitude of society to these women?
At that time, society was very proud of them. They were doing their war work. All women had to do war work. They understood that that was what they had to do. As soon as the war ended and the men started to come back, if they tried to hold on to their jobs, society would not have been so proud of them then. As a coincidence, I work at a local further education college, and all of my work is with engineering and construction in the built environment students. And even now, there are so few girls who sign up for those courses. Most years, we don't have any girls in those courses. Some years, there's one in a class of 20 to 25. In a good year, there might be two.
And I think you bring out really well the kind of conflict these women had about the war, and then obviously it was a very scary time, but being able to work gave them confidence and economic independence.
Yes, because of course they didn't want the war, they didn't like the war, they didn't like all their men being away. But for a lot of them, it was the first chance they'd had to go out to work. And a lot of them absolutely loved it from an economic point of view, having a bit of money to themselves or to spend on their children. I think also from a camaraderie point of view as well, to have that, to go to every day with a group of women in the same situation, sharing an experience. And also I think that it gave them a real sense of doing something vital and feeling that exhilaration at being important to the war effort.
And they were doing all this alongside, and you make this very clear in the novel, alongside all the domestic chores that they were still doing, even when they were living with fathers or husbands, they were still doing all the work, all the cooking, all the cleaning.
Oh, yes, definitely. I don't think it would have been considered in this country to be any different. I think sometimes when we think of women stepping into traditional male roles during the Second World War, we think of them as doing just that. But they had to, as you say, do that along with childcare, running the house, organising the food, which, as we know from being in lockdown, is a major task in itself, isn't it? Organising food, cooking food, caring for parents, visiting sisters, all of their usual work.
Thank you, Jan. Well, let's move on now a couple of years post-war, actually, and talk to Janet Todd about her novel. Janet is a former president of Lucy Cavendish College and helped found the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize. She's written biographies of Mary Wollstonecraft, Aphra Behn, and the Cambridge Introduction to Jane Austen. Her first novel, A Man of Genius, came out in 2016. The Times Literary Supplement called it mesmerising and haunting. The Radiation Diaries, her account of receiving treatment for cancer, came out in 2018. Her second novel, Don't You Know There's a War On, was published earlier this year. Hilary Mantel, no less, described it as frank, wry and unexpectedly heartening. When I spoke to Jan via Zoom, I asked her to tell me what the novel's about.
It's largely the monologue or the diary of a post-war woman, a woman who's typical of a certain kind of lower middle class aspirational woman growing up between the wars and then the war sort of coming and knocking her sideways and then coping with the huge cultural changes that come afterwards. she can't adapt and doesn't adapt. She's caught not only in the times, but also caught in her temperament. She's not a nice person. I'm fascinated by characters, protagonists who are not sympathetic, and her treatment of her only daughter is increasingly monstrous almost. It's not a feel-good novel. It's kind of dark. But I am fascinated by misfits, by oddities, by eccentrics. And I think that we're more and more intolerant of them than perhaps we were when I was younger. It's set primarily in the 40s and 50s, and then the actual moment in which she has started to write and thus spill out a life that she's totally repressed is 1976.
And this period post-war, post-Second World War, it's not a period that's often looked at, but it is a very particular period in time.
It is, and I need to bring in something else here, and that is that I've read an awful lot of books where a child is talking about the monstrous mother, the bad mothering, the unloving ways of that period. But very infrequently have I heard the voice of the mother. And what I wanted to do was give this woman a pen, you know, give her a voice. What is strange, now that we are in such a child-centered time of upbringing, is to look back on a period that really thought something quite different. After the war, the big guru, in the way that the guru of the 60s and 70s when I had children was Benjamin Spock. But that period looked to a man called Truby King. His idea was that to make a good adult is to start with a controlled infant, that a mother had to teach by not picking the child up, by not taking notice when it cried, to make a child that can internalize self-control. And she will grow up being self-controlled. And so not indulgent, not expecting the world to turn round them. I mean, it was a very rigid thing. And I know that my mother worked on that and said, guys, I wanted to pick you up and cuddle you, but I knew it was wrong. But this one goes further because it worked in my main character, who's called Joan. It works with her because she is somebody who has stunted herself emotionally. It's not typical of all people, and certainly not of the upper middle classes, or probably the lower, but of the lower middle. I think it had a certain typicality.
And how are you defining lower middle classes in those particular years?
People who come from backgrounds where neither parent is educated, who are a little bit above the working class and so have aspirations and are scared silly about being dragged back into the working class. At the same time, they're looking and desiring to be and to want and being envious of the upper middle, which is the one that has the confidence, the public school worlds. It's specific. I don't know whether it exists now quite like that. I doubt it. But my experience is that that class has mostly been mocked. And I'm thinking here of Hyacinth Bucket in Keeping Up Appearances. It's usually absurd. And yet there's something in a way, I hope, to convey something sort of moving about its efforts and its constant failures. One of the things that I do think is characteristic of this class is an enormous sense of embarrassment. It's embarrassed all the time, embarrassed if it's talking wrongly, saying the wrong thing, manners aren't right, but it wants to be. Whereas if you're in the lower working class, then you don't care a stuff about what other people think. And if you're in the upper middle, you don't much care either, but you jolly well care, or at least it did in this class in the post-war world.
And I'm interested that you've written it in the form of a diary in which she opens up and reveals all these dark secrets, because the last time I spoke to you was about your own diaries, the radiation diaries, in which you'd said that as you wrote them, you discovered lots of things about yourself. And I'm wondering if one fed into the other.
Not really, actually, because I started when I was an academic and I just needed to make money to keep going. I was just writing critical books, but I always wanted to be a novelist, and I started a lot of books, and this was one of them. And then, as I think you may remember, the diary wasn't really intended for publication. It was just something I did. But you're right, it's the same sort of process, though I didn't discover any absolutely central and seminal secret in the way that Joan does. I came to writing through the long periods of the 60s and 70s when self-expression was right, particularly the feminist movement. We were all supposed to let everything hang out. So I didn't find it difficult to write the diary when I was, in fact, I found it very comforting when I had cancer. But Joan is of the opinion that certain things had better be repressed. But if you start letting them out, they slither out and make a horrible mess of the present. It's interesting that maybe it isn't a good idea to revisit, because after all, the past is unalterable. And I think her view is, let sleeping dogs lie, let it stay there. But she finds that by writing, she inexorably comes towards these awful things.
And where does Joan come from? You mentioned your mum there and some of your own experiences.
Well, she doesn't actually come from my mother, who was quite different. She had, and always thought she had a rather lovely life and was quite sort of sophisticated. She comes from observations. I think when I kept coming back from America during the 60s and 70s and hearing people's views and the way they were bemused by my sort of feminism, by the more liberal attitudes that the left-wing upper middle class were holding anyway, but which I had now adopted. I was kind of interested in all that. But as a young child in the little town where I was born, there was a house that I passed from time to time. It was a bigger and fancier house than anything that we lived in. And it was owned by a woman on her own, who was presumably a widow, who had a daughter who'd been educated and became a doctor, which was something I had not at that point heard a woman could possibly do. And the daughter had had a breakdown. Again, what was that? And had come home to live with her. And the two women were in this house, and the curtains were always closed. I never saw them, but I became fascinated by the idea of somebody, of two people living alone in a house all that time. The idea of this home, this house that binds you and is your whole environment and somewhat imprisons you, as it does these two women, has fascinated me, I think, all my life.
Yes, you talk about being in prison there and locked together with someone. Of course, we're talking to each other in lockdown now. Any other parallels with that period of time and that relationship with our current situation?
We're all cleaning and doing things in the house and polishing in a way that I've never done before. I don't ever polish the table, but I have now. And doing craft things. That generation was very much into making do, mending. Everyone was doing embroidery, I remember. Exactly whether people have taken that up now, but there's become an emphasis on those domestic crafts, which for many years were much poo-pooed and mocked.
The mother and daughter relationship has been explored in various novels through the ages. As a literary scholar yourself, did you pull on any previous mother-daughter relationships in fiction?
I didn't find many, actually. Isn't it always from the daughter's point of view? Yeah, when you think of George Eliot and Jane Austen and Dickens, you're looking at these all-enveloping mothers, and I kind of like to look at it from the other angle. But and also, now that abortion and terminations are possible, I want to go back to the era in which they were not, and the idea that you are growing in your womb something that you do not want and that will resent you and you resent. Joan wonders what it's feeling in there. Are her resentments and hatreds getting through to it? What is this extraordinary relationship of a thing inside you growing in consciousness and you? And I wanted to explore that a little bit. It's after all such a primal relationship, the mother and daughter, and the moment of childbirth in which the two are separated and can never quite come back again. With Joan, I wanted her to create somebody too who, looking back to her mother, looks at the only period of tenderness, which is just after the birth, when they are not quite separated. So there is a kind of infantilism that has come over her because of this. But then when she has her own daughter, the weirdness of another being that has come out of you and which you've created, now growing away from you, is something that keeps striking her. She can't sort of believe that this child is different from her.
And I always think, for women who've lived during that period, the immense changes that they saw in, well, more sexual freedom, contraception, abortion, in the 70s, having a leader of the opposition who was a female, later to be prime minister. The benefits, in a way, that sometimes the generation below them were able to take more advantage of than they were.
I think one also has to remember that just after the war, there was a worry about surplus women, women who'd done all the work in the factories and had positions of considerable influence and experience and power, were told to go back and be wives. And the emphasis is all on keeping him, keeping that marriage. and the fear of the spinster, the divorcee, who will take your man, very, very strong in the late 40s and 50s. It's a very peculiar period of mothering, of being a wife, of being just a woman. And I, who came to adulthood to the end of that period and then was really bowled over by all the changes of the 60s, I have always been very fascinated by this period of the 40s and 50s and just how people negotiated something that was really very, very difficult.
Don't You Know There's a War On by Janet Todd is published by Fenton Press. Listening to that with me is our featured guest on Bookmark today, Jan Casey, here to talk about her debut novel, The Women of Waterloo Bridge. Jan, lots of resonances in Janet Todd's novel with your own. The self-control expected of people during the war.
They showed fortitude, they were stoic, they got on with things, and that was all part of this self-control that permeated their behaviour. They were emotional. I'm sure that there was a lot of crying and a lot of gnashing of teeth when they were by themselves. But I think women in particular had to be very, very stoic.
And this idea of after the war, this surplus of women that nobody really knew what to do with, who had now had this economic independence and newfound confidence.
They were still allowed to work, of course, but they were pushed back into what were called the service roles. So they would go into catering or caring roles in some way. I do also feel very sorry for men after the Second World War, because it must have been so difficult for them as well, coming back to a very changed world. And women who had different attitudes, they were much more independent, with a lot more confidence probably, had managed life very, very well without their husbands or fathers. So it was difficult for men also.
And Janet Todd also talking about class there and moving classes, the people's ambitions to move up a class. In your novel, it's Evelyn, really, isn't it, who climbs the class ladder?
That's right. And that did start for her before the war. She comes from probably a lower middle class family, but did well at school, so was able to become a teacher. But frustratingly, when she became engaged, she had to give up her teaching role. But she was very ambitious. She did, after the Second World War, want to carry on with an engineering career because she loved it so much. And that proved very difficult for her in this country also. But yes, she was trying very hard to climb the class ladder. I don't know if she would see it like that, but we can, a step back.
And any other resonances for you with lockdown? There was certainly quite a few for me as I read the novel. This kind of idea, siege mentality a little bit, scarcity of goods, making do, not knowing what tomorrow was bringing, relying on the government for information.
There are some resonances, but I do think that people had it so much worse than us during the Second World War. I know that right at the beginning of lockdown, it was difficult to get chickpeas, for example. But after a week or two, there were plenty of them on the shelf. None of us were going hungry. And people during the Second World War were probably, for most of the war, very, very hungry, suffering epidemics of terrible flu and bronchitis and pneumonia, those sorts of things. Yeah, relying on the government, of course, that's what they had to do as well. But I think that they really had it much, much harder, of course, than we have. We don't open our doors every morning and wonder what the night's bombing left.
Yes, the changes in landscape that happened literally overnight in hours.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
Let's hear your second choice of music now then, Jan. This is The Beach Boys and God Only Knows. Why this one?
I grew up in Southern California. I moved there with my family when I was 2, and we moved back when I was 18. And the Beach Boys have been the soundtrack to my life. They've aged as I've aged and become interested in things other than going to the beach and surfing. And this particular song, God Only Knows, again, the lyrics are absolutely beautiful, very simple. and I would like to play this for my husband, my sons and daughters and their partners, my five beautiful grandchildren.
And today on Bookmark, our featured guest is Jan Casey, talking about her novel, The Women of Waterloo Bridge, about the women who built Waterloo Bridge during World War II. One of the things I really liked about the novel, Jan, was the way the women talked about relationships, because relationships do feature in the novel, amongst other things, but they're quite bawdy. There was a real sense of enjoyment in the relationships.
Young women in particular during that period of time were very ambitious to find good partners, to find a good husband to take care of them. And they enjoyed going out and meeting a lot of different men, sifting through them, if you like, trying to find the one that was right for them. But there are also relationships in the book with parents and their grown-up children, parents and their small children. I think that life is really relationships. And at that period of time, when there was no TV, there was no Netflix, there were no smartphones, I think relationships, face-to-face relationships, were very, very important.
And we're talking during lockdown about monuments a lot at the moment, which also ties in with your novel and the importance of monuments during wartime, Big Ben in particular.
Big Ben was a monument that Londoners kept their eye on all the time. Big Ben and St. Paul's in particular in London. They seemed to think if those two monuments were standing, then all was well.
And I love that you have the women carving their initials into the bridge. Yes. Is there any other sign on the bridge of their contribution?
I don't think there is actually on the bridge. There are some photos, very, very few photos, but there are some that I've seen of women actually working on the bridge. It was of strategic importance, and so it was very secretive at the time. It was covered as much as possible, so it couldn't be seen from the air. And I don't think photography was welcomed during that time, although the Daily Herald did take a few photos. But a monument has been erected not far from Waterloo Bridge now, and that's to all of the women who worked in construction during the Second World War. And that's happened within the last 10 years.
The ones who got a particular level were known as lady engineers, weren't they?
Yes, in the same way that there were lady doctors.
Yes, a prefix before, yes. But there was a Women Engineers Society, which is amazing, really, when you think about it, because the career path would have been very hard and quite limited.
That's right, yes. I think it would have, again, would have had to come from a very upper class family with very liberal parents to enable a young woman to go into that career path.
How frustrating I felt all the way through for these women who were very bright, liberated by this role, and then not able to continue it. One of your characters does her best to, but that must have been a common experience. All these maybe great engineers, great academics or medics that never were.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it, when you think about it? Some women went on to do the best that they could at that period of time. So they went into teaching, perhaps, because by the end of the war, you could be married and have a teaching job, or went into offices and worked with accounts. I think there were a lot of frustrated women after the Second World War, and women who were very sad for what they could have been. And society should be very sad for them too. We have missed out, haven't we? It's not very foresightful of a society to let that workforce go in that way.
And are there descendants around? Presumably there are, of the women who worked on the bridge.
I haven't found any. There is a woman called Karen Livesey. She wrote and directed a very, very short film about the women of Waterloo Bridge, and it actually went into some schools, secondary schools, with a list of questions. I think it was used in diversity and history, that sort of thing. And in it, she interviewed some women who'd worked on construction, not on the bridge, but in construction during the Second World War. But nobody seems to have been forthcoming. Nobody seems to have been able to find anyone. One of my mother's best friends during the Second World War lived in Bermondsey, which is right near the docks. And she told me that she remembered the bridge being rebuilt, but she could not remember women on it.
Interesting how they've been forgotten, isn't it?
Whitewashed or forgotten, or it was just such a different period of time, and women who were engaged in it just thought, well, that's been and gone. It's not a part of my life anymore. And they didn't remember it as being anything unusual for the time.
Thank you, Jan. We'll come back to you in just a moment. We'll take a slight sidestep for the time being. Kettle's Yard in Cambridge is a gallery housing modern and contemporary art. Last month, they published Alfred's Adventures in the Children's City, aimed at introducing the work of the painter Alfred Wallace to a young audience. I spoke to Imogen Alexander from the gallery to find out more.
Alfred's Adventure in the Children's City is a story about the painter Alfred Wallace, who takes his paintings up to the families in the north of Cambridge, and together they explore his paintings and share stories and adventures together inspired by them. And it's based on a project that took place at the beginning of this year in partnership between Kettle's Yard and the Red Hen Project, where we would pack up not Alfred's actual paintings, but copies of them and all sorts of related books and art materials, and go and explore them together as part of the project Play and Picture Books, which was funded by Talking Together in Cambridgeshire and was based in the Church Hall of the Good Shepherd in Arbury.
And why Alfred Wallace's paintings in particular?
Alfred Wallace is a painter who forms a key part of the Kettle's Yard collection, and he painted these fantastic seascapes completely from memory, inspired by his life on the seas as a fisherman. And they're very immediate. He had no art training. People are drawn to them because they're so evocative. You can almost smell the sea when you look at them, and they really, I think, encourage everyone to dive in and remember the time they went to the sea or the book they read about the sea, and they're a lot of fun.
And there's a naivety to his work as well, isn't there? He's been called a naive artist. Do you think that's something that particularly resonates with children?
I think actually it resonates with lots of people. People enjoy his works at all ages, but definitely there's something very attractive about that. And the modernist artists kind of picked him up as a bit of a poster boy of modernism because of that naivety, because he broke the rules that they were trying to unlearn.
It's quite nice as well to be looking at ships in landlocked Cambridge as well, isn't it?
And even more so in lockdown.
And this is aimed at children as well. So is this part of a wider project about trying to engage children with art?
With art and also with stories. So the project was funded by Talking Together in Cambridgeshire, which is the literacy funding, and it's all about encouraging families to explore stories, but also just exchange words together. And we found that using an artwork as a starting point for this was a really good way into then building up a shared, meaningful vocabulary and exploring stories and paintings and just having a lot of fun.
Alfred Wallace is a very esteemed artist. How did his work end up at Kettle's Yard?
There were two artists, Ben Nicholson and Christopher Wood, who stumbled across Alfred Wallace painting in St Ives and started correspondence with him and introduced him to Jim Eade, the founder of Kettle's Yard. And they became great friends, and Alfred Wallace used to pack up hundreds of his paintings and send them to Jim. And Kettle's Yard has not only over 100 of his paintings, but also all the letters that they used to exchange.
And you've started with Alfred Wallace, but are there plans to do other books along the same lines with other artists?
So we have applied to run a similar literacy project next year. We're talking together in Cambridgeshire and are hoping to explore the artist Shutapa Biswas, who will be having an exhibition of her work at Kettle's Yard next year. And she has done some fantastic works in the past, which are all about exchanging stories. So we'd love to use that as a starting point for a new book.
And this book, tell me a little bit about that. If I was to open it, what kinds of things would I see in there?
So the book has been illustrated by the illustrator Rose Feather. And she was part of the workshops that we ran in North Cambridge earlier this year. After every workshop, she'd draw everything that had happened. So you'd meet the real children who were part of this project, and you'd also see Alfred Wallace. Each of the illustrations are made using a collage of Rose's illustration and found objects, and in that way they're very similar to Alfred Wallace's work, who used to paint on anything available to him. He'd paint on scraps of cardboard or packaging, whatever he could lay his hands on.
I wonder what he'd think about this book.
I like to think that he'd really enjoy it. Particularly, he started painting because he was lonely, because his wife had died. And there's something in this story about Alfred being lonely and going and finding company and adventures with children up in Cambridge. And I think he'd feel heartened that his works were sparking all sorts of new adventures.
And again, that's another thing that resonates with lockdown, isn't it?
Very much so. And having adventures with just what's available right in front of you, I think, is what all families are doing up and down the country right now.
And to find out more and for a copy of Alfred's Adventures in the Children's City, go to kettlesyard.co.uk. Our featured guest on Bookmark today has been Jan Casey, talking about her novel, The Women of Waterloo Bridge, which is published by ARIA. So, Jan, what was the journey from manuscript to publication for you?
When the manuscript was complete, or I thought it was complete and finished and edited, I started to send it off to agents. And I think I probably sent it to about 30 to 35 agents, not all at the same time, of course, and waited for their replies. Some of them asked for the whole manuscript and then came back to me and said that it wasn't for them. Eventually, an agent named Kieran Kataria asked me to make a number of changes, a number of edits, which I then ploughed through and delivered back to her. So she took me on. And after that, she began to send out to publishers. So I looked through all of the information they sent me, and ARIA, the publisher that I'm with, very interested in not just the manuscript, but in my career as well. So I eventually decided to go with them. And then, of course, had a number of other edits to do for them.
Because ARIA are a digital publisher. How is that different, if at all?
I think a digital first publisher differs from a print first publisher in that, rather than a traditional book launch, the digital first publisher will launch a book on social media using Twitter, Facebook, Goodreads, NetGalley, that sort of process. So the writer's very involved in retweeting and publishing for themselves. I have seen now that my book is print on demand as well as digital. So the book is ready to be printed as a paperback, and anybody who wants to read it that way can do so. And so it's mainly, I think, the social media that's different. And I suppose it gets out to various places much more quickly than print.
What about for you? Because as a writer, it's a dream to see it in your hand, you know, to see a work, to see your novel in your hand. You can see it on a Kindle. Has that made you feel any differently about it?
Initially, it did, because you're right. It was always a dream to have a book, a physical book that I'd written in bookshops or in the library. So initially, I wondered if I was shortchanging myself. But after conversations with my agent and then with ARIA, I did realise that this is just the way the world is going, and it is absolutely no different. Years and years ago, writers would have thought that it was very strange to be to have a publishing house churning out book after book after book that they'd written. So it's just a dynamic process. Things change and they move on. It just seems to be the way the world, publishing world, is going. And now I certainly don't feel any different at all. And in fact, I'm very, very pleased for choosing ARIA. They're very good to work with, excellent to work with.
And they're going to be publishing your next two books, so you need to feel comfortable with them, and you obviously do. And have you, as a first-time novelist, are you manically checking sales and reviews on Amazon and other websites if we're talking about social media?
Yes, it's so addictive. Initially, when the book was first published, I was checking, I think, every 5 to 10 minutes. And then I told myself after a couple of weeks, this couldn't go on. So I limit myself now to a couple of times a day, which is still quite a lot, isn't it? But it's remarkable how quickly it's updated on Amazon in particular. And I can check and it might be 681 in their top 1,000, and then check again in the evening and it's gone to down to 1,083. It's up and down, and it is very interesting, and it's very fun. The other remarkable thing is, and I don't have any say in this, it's where the book is published on social media, or the categories that it's published in. So it's, I don't know, number 28 in relationships, it's number 54 in psychology. So it's in targeted in so many different areas. So if people are looking for books in those very specific areas, they will come across my book as well as a number of others. So it's the marketing is very interesting and very specific.
What's next for you then after that? Are you tempted to take any of these characters further? Because there are several who could go further, in my opinion.
I have had a number of reviews for this book who say that they would like to have some follow-on. So that might be in the future. I have another book coming out next May, again, set during the Second World War. And that is going to be told from the point of view of a young woman in England and a young woman in Germany.
And we'll listen to your final piece of music in just a moment, but a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
At the moment I'm reading The Girl in the Tree by Şebnem İşgüzel. It's in translation from the Turkish, and it's set during Turkish riots that happened in, I think it was 2008, when a park in Istanbul was going to be demolished for flats. It's very interesting.
Lovely. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you today on Bookmark, Jen. I'll come back to you, as I say, in just a moment for your last choice of music. But heads up, the next show, which is the final show in this series, our featured guest is dramatist Craig Baxter. We'll also hear from Holly Race about the first in her fantasy trilogy, Midnight Twins, and James Nicol will be talking to us about his series of books about an apprentice witch. But let's hear your last choice of music now, which I suppose is inevitable, really, isn't it? The Kinks and Waterloo Sunset. Do I need to ask why this one? I will anyway. Why this one?
Well, it's based around Waterloo Bridge, and it's just so resonant of London, I think.